a lot of Americans are just absolutely ignorant and confused about the state of the country of Afghanistan. So let's, I think, bring some of the listeners up to date on just what's happening there now. How dire were things going into this current crisis, and now how bad is the acute humanitarian crisis that's developed in the last couple of weeks?
Afghanistan was devastated by 10 years of the presence of the Soviet Army from 1979 to 1989, and a civil war since then that has raged on relentlessly. Afghanistan has also been in the midst of, in the middle of a three-year drought that has been quite severe and has really exhausted the resources of the population quite badly. And currently, there are two factors. One, the drought that already was getting people to move out. And second, is a combination of fear in voting with their feet by people. Fear because they're afraid of U.S. attacks. And voting by their feet because they do not trust the Taliban and would like to show that they are not affiliated with the Taliban.
And now we hear that the Taliban are losing control of the country. Is that true in your estimation?
The Taliban, by losing the country, you mean losing the trust of the people. Indeed, the Taliban are really disliked now.
Were they ever liked, widely liked?
Initially, in some regions of the country, they were liked. Because prior to them, there were a series of warlords who brought mayhem and an immense amount of suffering to the people. And these warlords were the ones that had been, during the Soviet period of occupation, supported through funds by the United States and in other groups. And when the Taliban initially rose in southern Afghanistan and brought about a kind of initial security of person and property, they were welcome.
But now?
As time went on, first they failed to deliver any benefits to the people in terms of health, in terms of education, in terms of improvement of living standards, and the severe problems that were occupying the people. Second, they started imposing a very rigid interpretation of Islam on a population that previously it had a very tolerant practice of Islam. For instance, they started beating men for not having beards or the right size of the beard. They restricted the movements of women, and they restricted the ability of women to work. These were the type of issues that caused tremendous amount of alienation on the part of the population. And the other is, they did not provide any sense of participation to the people. For instance, they have not issued a single written document resembling a constitution or a basic set of laws to specify what the rights of the people are and not just their obligation. And when a severe earthquake hurt northern Afghanistan, where thousands of people were made homeless and a lot of people were killed, or when the drought came, their leader issued an edict saying that these were punishments and inflicted on the people for their sins and for the lack of obedience to the Taliban.
Now, I think a lot of Americans have an image of a population of Afghanistan as being backward, ignorant, and really that the Taliban emerged from that. That's not a fair impression at all, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, first thing is that if this doesn't offend sensibilities of some of your listeners, the average Afghan is far more aware and keenly interested in following world developments than the average American, because the average American does not depend on the world at large. The average Afghan, over at least 80% of the Afghan population, are glued to the transistor radios following the services of the BBC and Voice of America and Persian and Pashto, that are the main languages. It's a people that are keenly interested in notions of freedom, in notions of individual dignity, and a sense of community. If it were not for those qualities, remember that at the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union walked over Eastern Europe and Central Asia and flexed its muscle continuously. But when it entered Afghanistan, a country that barely had a functioning army, they were driven by the people. You could not expect that kind of mobilization if the people did not have the inner resources to be able to take the sacrifice of loss of over a million lives. So to characterize the people of Afghanistan as being ignorant and deserving the Taliban is to really forget history and the tremendous sense of cultural security that the people have had. And the other is to forget that the warlords that were unleashed upon the population of Afghanistan received the bulk of their money, their arms, their training from international community, particularly the United States. And no one paid any attention to what would happen once the Soviets withdrew.
Now there's talk of making another pact with regional warlords or powers, the Northern Alliance. Who are they, and is this a risky potential alliance the U.S. and its allies are contemplating?
The Northern Alliance is several components. One of its components are a group of warlords who, according to Amnesty International and other human rights watch organizations, have had a poor human rights record. There's another component that is composed of young people with a lot of sense of dedication to their communities and a willingness to take up arms, not to submit to the Taliban. The third is that there are groups of individuals and communities who represent distinctive aspirations and would not like to be subordinated either to the religious doctrine of the Taliban or their perceived linguistic group. The group to which linguistically the Taliban belong is not the same as that of Northern Alliance, because people in the Northern Alliance either speak Turkic languages or Persian, and the majority of the Taliban leaders speak Pashto, which is the language that is shared with Pakistan. In terms of prospect, it really is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, this alliance can become an instrument for weakening of Taliban, but on the other, if their previous tendencies are not controlled and they engage in any kind of practices that resemble their past, the population would be very quickly alienated and could turn towards the Taliban.
I'm speaking with the anthropologist Ashraf Ghani. I should say it's also WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. There also is talk of bringing back the king, who is 86 years old and been living in Italy for the last several decades. Is this a promising strategy in your view?
There are two components to this again. One is that the king indeed is 86. And because of it, he could potentially play a symbolic role in ushering in a process of transition whereby a transitional government is formed, and at the end of that period, Afghans will be able to freely decide on their future and on their future leaders. That's the promising part of the strategy, because personally, he's very popular, and the reason for that is basically not because of what he's accomplished, but because his successors, if it's such a horrendous record, that in retrospect, his period is now looked upon as a golden age. But because the majority of the Afghans were under 25, if not seen the king or witnessed his reign, there are also going to be quite a few questions should he play a more active role, or close members of his family, like his sons or son-in-laws and others, get involved in directly running the affairs of the government. In that case, instead of becoming a focus of unity, it could become a focus of disunity.
In the days initially after September 11th, there was a lot of talk about just bombing the hell out of Afghanistan and taking vengeance. That seems to have cooled off a bit. I mean, do you get the sense that people in power have come to understand the complexities of the situation?
I think they have. I think the administration has a very clear sense of the complexity involved in engaging in a place, in military action, in a place like Afghanistan. It's an incredibly complex place, not just in its own rights and in terms of the challenges that it presents, but in terms of further implications that lack of stability in Afghanistan caused by some U.S. action or international action could have on the neighboring countries first, and then on the Islamic world in general. So I think that the degree of complexity is being very clearly grasped.
What would be the effects if the U.S. and its allies launched some sort of major bombing campaign?
Of course, it depends on what else accompanies that and what the bombing campaign, what's the objective of the bombing campaign. The administration today has moved very clearly to make a major commitment to the relief of the Afghan population and has picked up the humanitarian issues very well. And I think that is the type of orientation, particularly when it comes from the president himself, that gives the people of Afghanistan a sense that their issues are being understood and attended to. The key issue is whether, one, there will be a clear commitment to the reconstruction of Afghanistan after the Taliban, and second will be as a roadmap, as the political roadmap as to what the post-Taliban regime would look like and what kind of assistance would the international community provide in facilitating the formation of a government that truly would be representative and would be able to both address the dire needs of the people and give them a sense of representation.
Well, would a representative government be a united one that's capable of pursuing a sort of coherent agenda, or is the population really so fragmented that it'd be hard to put together a representative, effective government?
I think it's a question of phases. The first phase, effectiveness, means essentially small and not focusing all the resources that are going to be coming on the capital city. The critical issue is going to be even-handedness in addressing the problems of the country in general and those of the poor people in areas in particular. During this phase, given timing, to expect that a fully representative government through the will of the people will be elected is not likely. However, what can be done during this phase and would be imperative is a government that represents the social pluralism of the Afghan society and his people in it who represent the various linguistic groupings in the country, the various regional groupings in the country, and overall shows a broad face that the diversity of the country is reflected within the government, but that the government simultaneously is a program of action that gives it unity. And then the task would be to allow for the formation of political parties and movements in the country that could put forth agendas on the basis of which, through elections, a true basis for representation could be formed.
In a lot of minds, I think the Taliban and Osama bin Laden and his network have just all become blended together into a single entity that strikes fear and hatred into American hearts. Are these things that tightly bound together, or are they just different groups sort of allied with separate missions?
They're different. Essentially, they're different groups aligned in different ways. Osama bin Laden is very close to the leader of the Taliban, whose name is Mullah Omar. And it's that closeness and unity of purpose that has made Mullah Omar prefer his friendship with Osama bin Laden to the faith of his own people, or to the end, as well as to confrontation with his closest former allies, Pakistan, and willingness not to engage in meaningful discussion with the United States. The followers of Osama bin Laden are not popular in Afghanistan because they are not concerned about Afghan issues. And there's a fair amount of resentment against him, even by those sections of the Taliban that had a more nationalist agenda. And because they do not belong to the country and now are perceived to have brought a tragedy to the world and upon the country, I think that they will be fairly isolated in the event of a meaningful transition taking place in the country.
Well, have they all skipped town, or do they have nowhere to go?
Some of them have nowhere to go, because some of these people are wanted by their own governments for criminal conduct. And consequently, they're really on the loose. And the tragedy of Afghanistan is precisely because it wasn't an organized government in a state with the dedication to the welfare of its people. It became a haven for elements that are not welcome to a lot of the other places. Some of the other ones who don't have a distinctive record and are not wanted by their governments, of course, would be able to be free to move. But a lot of Middle Eastern governments are extremely wary of people who are associated with having been in Afghanistan during these years. So they are highly suspect.
And finally, what's your view of the future? Are you frightened that bad things are going to happen, or are you reasonably optimistic that there might be some kind of humane resolution to this crisis?
Well, with my heart, I'm hoping for more humanist resolution. With my mind, I'm fearful, of course, because the possibility of use of force is ever present. And if things don't change rapidly, there is a major risk that force would be used. And once force is used, it creates its own conditions on the ground and its own unanticipated consequences. And then we're in a completely different set of relationships, because some of these groups that have resorted to extremism would then justify their further inhumane actions by reference to what may have happened.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Ashraf Ghani, who is an anthropologist born in Afghanistan, now living near Washington.